Human Services Committee to order, and we will open an organizational meeting. And Rick, tell us about the blue light.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, that's what you're talking about.
Thank you, Chair. We do have a new recording system in each hearing room. We've gone from tape deck to digital. Part of the new system is that whenever the system, and since we have public meetings, they have to be recorded. Whenever the blue light is solidly on, it means the microphones are live and we are being recorded. If you ever see the blue light flash, it means we're in pause. The mics are still on, but we're not recording, and then when it's off, we're not recording. So this will help cue members at the dais that what you're saying when the blue light is solidly on is being part of the record. And so I just want to give you that's a little bit new this year.
And that's what Rick just said. When it's on, everything you say, even if I've gaveled out the meeting or we're in a recess and that light is on, you can be heard and you will be recorded and you will be on the record. Just think about that.
So this is utilizing more energy, so we're exerting.
That I don't know.
So
they are LED lights.
More greenhouse gases being emitted because of that.
I'm sure it's LED lights.
Yes, sir.
Before we start out, I just want you to know that today is Oregon Public Health Association Day, and we have some of the members here in the audience, OPHA. Thank you all for coming. And I'd like to do introductions, and maybe we could start down here. What I'd like you to do is tell us who you are, how long you've been in the... Thank you. Appreciate that. And how long you've been in the legislature, what you've done before that, how you got here, just briefly, but we'd just like to get to know you.
Good.
So, Representative Freeman.
Thank you. I'm Tim Freeman. I'm the representative from House District 2, which is parts of Douglas County, Josephine, and Jackson. Brand new. It's my first session. Spent 5 years on the Roseburg City Council. Own a business in Roseburg, a Shell service station.
Thank you.
I'm Suzanne Van Orman. This is my first session, having been elected in November. I'm a former Head Start director in the Gorge area, having done that for 22 years in the Oregon counties of Hood River, Wasco, and Jefferson, and in the Washington counties of Klickitat and Skamania. I also have experience as a city commissioner in the city of Oregon City, having done that for 10 years.
Thank you very much.
John Huffman, and I'm also in the Gorge. I'm Suzanne's neighbor just to the east of her in District 59, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson County, a little bit of North Deschutes, tiny pieces of East Clackamas and Marion counties, which they tell me are uninhabited, and if that is in truth, then why do I have them? But anyway, that's a retired broadcaster and own and manage commercial property and whatnot.
Thank you.
I'm Deborah Boone, and I represent the House District 32 with the beautiful upper left coast of our state. And this is starting my 21st year in the building, but not as a representative. This is my third term as a representative. I've been a legislative assistant for the 8 different legislators before me, and I honestly can't remember what all I did before that, other than I was a county commissioner in Clatsop. And then I used to own a catering company. So I had one visit from the health department, and that's kind of my introduction to health.
Thank you, Representative Boone. We'll start down with her with Michael.
My name is Michael Dembro, and I have been representing House District 45, that's Northeast Portland, Park Rose and Maywood Park for all of 5 days, and it's a great honor and pleasure. My background is working as a community college teacher, which I've done for almost 30 years, and also a longtime labor leader. I was the president of the faculty at PCC for 16 of those years, and spent the last 3 years on the State Board of Education. And it's a real honor to be on this particular committee, working with this particular chair.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, Ron Maurer from Grants Pass, serving House District 3, which is most of Josephine County. And my background, retired military reserves, and my wife and I own a very, very small rural health clinic in Rogue River, Oregon, for the next 44 days. We are in the process of selling that business. And so I will be doing other endeavors. My wife is in medical school, so it's a good thing. Anyway, and actually looking forward to not having to run the business.
Yes, thank you. Jean.
Good morning. I'm Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10, which is the Central Oregon Coast, Lincoln County, Northern Lane County, parts of Yamhill, Polk, and a little piece of Tillamook County. This is my second term in the legislature. My background prior to that is in local government, as 12 years as a county commissioner in Lincoln County, previously a mayor of a small community in eastern Oregon, as well as some work in the medical field as an EMT and in medical offices. And I have to admit I have a little bias this morning, as after a number of years on the Public Health Advisory Board, the Local Government Advisory Committee to DHS, and primary responsibility with human services at the county. So there you go.
Happy to have you back. Thank you.
My name is Andy Olson, and I'm back for my second session here with the chair, mainly because she wanted me as her bodyguard. Anyways, this is my third term that I've been here in Salem, and I wanted to come back on this committee and work with Representative Tomei, because I enjoy her and, you know, have a lot of respect for her. And this is just kind of a fun committee from what we had 2 years ago. I felt like we really moved some pretty good policy 2 years ago, and there were some things that we didn't agree with at the very beginning, but, I mean, we were willing to take some time out to find some common ground and make some dang good policy, and that's what I appreciated about this committee. I come here with a background of having been in law enforcement for 29 years, and now I'm back on judiciary as well, so this is going to be a nice little marriage for me for my two committees.
Great. We're glad to have you back. I'm Carolyn Tomei, and I represent Milwaukee and Southeast Portland House District 41, and I'm a retired social worker in schools and in social services for many years, and I love this committee. I asked for this committee, and I'm delighted to have it, and asked for many of you, and I'm so pleased that you have agreed to be on this committee. I think the work we do here is the hardest work that is done in this building, and I think what makes it the hardest is that we're going to be seeing people with a lot of needs coming before our committee this year. And we're not going to be able to meet all of those needs, and that's going to be really tough on us, tough on the public. But I agree with Representative Olson and others who have been on the committee before. We can do good work, and we will be doing good work, and we're going to have a good time along the way. We're going to develop some good policy. It's going to be great fun, and we're going to learn more about the whole state. We're going to learn about the needs in every area of our state, and we're going to meet some wonderful people. One of the things, for those of you who are new to the committee, is that punctuality, I think, is important, not just to me personally, but I think to the people who come to our meetings. If we're expecting people to be here at a certain time, then we should be here to greet them and to start the meeting on time. The other part is, I'm asking you to stay for the whole meeting. There will be times when you've got to leave for a certain thing to do, but I've heard from the public, and I've been on the other side over there, when sometimes there is one committee member. That is just totally unacceptable. If people come from all over the state, and this is a big state, if they come here to talk to us, we need to be here to listen to them and talk back to them. This is our first responsibility in this meeting, or in this building, is when we are assigned to committees, we need to be on these committees. And it should not be a burden. I don't want it to make it sound like going to school or something like that, where you have to be here whether you want to be or not. I hope that it's something that we all enjoy doing, and I think we're hearing from people who were on this committee before that it can be an enjoyable experience, and I think we're going to learn to enjoy each other. The other thing is, and this is for the public as well as for people in this committee, and I think I've met with everybody before our meeting, But in the past, and a lot of you who have been involved in coming to the legislative meetings in the past, you realize that many of the bills will be sent to Ways and Means to die. We're not going to be allowed to do that anymore. If we send a bill from here into Ways and Means, we're going to need to prioritize. So if we don't feel that a certain bill is going to have a chance of surviving Ways and Means, we will not be sending it to Ways and Means. And if it goes to Ways and Means, I particularly ask to be on the Ways and Means sub, so that if we send, and this, we're going to be working collaboratively. I'm not going to be sending, I hope I will never send a bill 5-4. I hope everything will be 9-0, maybe 8-1 if somebody has a real problem. But I'm going to be working with you to make sure that we can send bills that we can all agree on. But if it goes to Ways and Means, I'm going to need your help to help me go to Ways and Means and say, this is why we need to fund this bill. I will fight for it, but I'm going to need your help to do that. Is there anything I've forgotten? Oh, yes. And, of course, we're so lucky to have Rick here. Everybody knows Rick Bercovian. He is just par excellence staff person. Well, Keeley, where's...
Right here.
Oh, Keeley is going to be our staff person. She just joined us this week. She has hit the ground running, so we're lucky to have her, but she's going to be letting Rick sort of take care of us today. And Zach Deal is going to be our helper also. So thank you, Zach. And I don't know this other lady.
I'm just here to help Zach this
morning. She's just here to help Zach. Okay, thank you so much. Oh, thank you. One of the things I always ask people to do is turn off their cell phones. And I don't mean just turn them on, off to vibrate, because it does affect the sound system. So please turn off your cell phones, your Blackberries, and I hope I will never see anybody texting up here. I will be very cranky about that. No texting, no cell phone numbers. So,
well, Madam Chair, just so you know that as we go paperless and people kind of, there will be computers.
There will be computers, and if I see a bunch of cards up there,
I'll just see here. Let's see, how's this work?
We have those privacy screens.
Thank you.
I think those in restrooms. Okay. Have I done everything that I needed to, Rick?
I'll set about just explaining the rules and adopting them.
Okay. So I think everybody got the rules in their emails. Yeah, Rick, tell us a little bit about the rules.
Thank you. These are very similar to committee rules that members who have been here last session have seen, but since we do have a number of new members, I'll just briefly take about 2 minutes and go through them point for point, and then if there's questions, discuss those. You do have the rules in front of you. Number one, to amend rules, it does require a majority, and you must give 1 day's written notice to the committee if you do wish to amend the rules. A quorum is a majority of the members. If no quorum is here, the chair can assign fewer members to receive public testimony, but there must be at least one member at the dais for that to occur. It is the chair who calls meetings and sets agendas. The speaker can appoint subcommittees, and then the chair can assign or remove measures from a subcommittee once it is appointed by the speaker. And then the chair can be a voting member on that subcommittee. All committee notices must specify the type of hearing, such as public hearing, work session, that type of thing. And during a public hearing, testimony must be allowed. But not necessarily during a work session, although the chair is not precluded during a work session from requesting people come forward to talk to a bill. Number seven, we do allow carryovers from one hearing to the next, which means before the chair gavels out, if they don't finish business on one bill, they can announce to the committee they're going to carry it over to the next appropriate, to the next meeting, as long as it's the same kind of bill that was noticed. You can go from a public hearing to a public hearing. You cannot carry over from a public hearing to a work session. And so that will occur probably periodically during session. And then we must revise the agenda. Measures that had work sessions, and I think this somewhat alludes to Chair Tomei's reference about some of the fiscal revenue implications that when you adopt, when you discuss a measure and you adopt amendments or you decide to pass the bill out, we must have the fiscal and revenue statements here for the bill to actually be reported out of committee. There will be times when you will probably adopt amendments, but we won't have had time to get the amendments or revenue statements in committee. In that case, we can adopt the amendments, but we have to wait until the bill might be carried over for the next couple meetings and until we can get the fiscal and revenue information for the committee to review. And so in the past, I think committees have been allowed to pass bills out without having the fiscal revenue always at the dais. This is a change with this year's rules.
And this is a very important change. Representative Maurer.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. So just to clarify, we will have adopted the bill language. For example, if we don't have a fiscal, we can adopt the bill, and then we wait for the fiscal statement to be received, and then we have to vote again to move it out of committee.
Yes.
Because if there is a fiscal, an example would be if a fiscal came back that was unexpectedly large, or there was some, it might change a person's vote based on that fiscal.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
So we theoretically could have two votes on the same bill.
Right.
In fact, it's very likely, well, maybe not in this committee as much, but okay. Yeah. I just want to make that.
That's my understanding. That's
okay.
Yours.
Yes. And then when the fiscal revenue do come back to committee, if the committee again decides to amend it or have another amendment, they would have to, again, we'd have to wait for the new fiscal and revenue information to come back for that bill. So we always, the rule of thumb is to move the bill out of committee, there must be the fiscal revenue on the bill that's going to move out of committee as adopted or to pass.
Madam Chair.
I'm not sure who had their hand up first. Suzanne?
Madam Chair.
Norman, yes.
So in terms of fiscal, we're looking at the single solitary bill in terms of the finances. But when we send it to the Ways and Means, then they would see how it would fit in the big picture. And then there would be a different decision made at that level.
Oh, yeah. Sending it to Ways and Means does not mean necessarily it will be voted.
Right. And they would do the big picture look.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm probably, and to that question, too, I'm probably jumping out of order. In the past, committees have been allowed to, if a bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, to get what they call a hall pass, basically a piece of paper that allows us to get it to Ways and Means. Contrary, we're going to have also the fiscal revenue here, even if it's going to Ways and Means from this committee. So that will be a little bit of a change also from how we've done it in the past.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. It may be a little redundant, but if it's amended and it comes back, we'll have the opportunity to look at the amendments and everything and vet it out.
Oh,
again.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Great. Thank you, Rick. You continue.
And now I've lost a little bit of where I was.
I think you're number 8.
Okay. And I just explained, yes, that we cannot, basically, you'll be kind of taking the bill up for final consideration when you've got everything in front of you with fiscal and revenue, and that's when you'll move the bill out or decide not to move it out. And then number 9, all meetings must be open to the public and press. Chairs can set time in public testimony when there's a lot of people in the room. The chair can decide that people get X amount of time just to make sure we get as many people as possible. Members can, a member of the full committee can attend a subcommittee if one is so appointed but can't be there for a vote or be considered as part of a quorum. A majority vote is required for any action such as bill introduction, table a measure, or move a measure, amend a measure, send a measure to the floor, approve recommendations, and these activities must take place during usually a work session. Motions don't require a second. Roll call is required if at least two members request it. And then with minority reports, and this is a little bit different than I think members who were here last session are may recall, they only apply to a measure being reported out by committee. At least two members must subscribe to a minority report, and they must have been a no vote on the committee report. The notice of the minority report must be given to the chair or administrator by 5 o'clock that day of the committee. If the committee does run longer than 5 o'clock, then it must be before the chair gavels out. So if the meeting runs till 5:30, before the chair drops the gavel, you must let me or her know or the administrator know that you're giving notice of possible minority report. You didn't have 48 hours or 5 o'clock of the second business day, which is ever earlier, to get the report, including the amendments, to the administrator. And that a minority report must be filed with the clerk the same day that the committee report goes to the clerk's office. They're basically what we call dropped on the same day. And then no member can sign up for more than one minority report on the same issue.
Just a minute. I think, Representative Olson, did you have a question about that?
The only thing that I was going to bring it up during discussion on it, but I think we're there. I just wanted to, confirm that, from your perspective, you're good to go with that section 15 for that,
sure.
For the recognized minority report.
And I've met with all of you, and one of the things I've asked is no surprises. I'm not going to surprise you about anything, and if you just don't surprise me, just that would be wonderful.
There goes our strategy.
Okay.
Is that it?
That's
it.
Okay,
thanks. And then just for number 16, this is a little bit different. A minority report must have the amendments here at the committee, at the dais, to give notice, and must have been distributed to the committee. This is, again, a little bit different than last session, but the amendments must be at least put in as an exhibit so all members have seen it. The only exemption or exception to this would be that if there is a work session on the bill within 24 hours of the first public hearing, then we kind of revert back to we basically give time to go out and get the amendment drafted. I believe this allows for ideas that might come forward rather quickly before we've had a chance for someone to bring a minority amendment to the dais, if that's clear. And then number 17, amendments other than from members must be given to the committee staff at least 48 hours before a work session. And then 18, no measure can be reported out unless the LC draft and fiscal statements have been distributed and reviewed. That was what we discussed earlier, that everything has to be at the dais, fiscal revenue, with any amendments that are adopted prior to being reported out of committee. And then any clerical errors that might come up in a bill or amendment don't need necessarily a majority approval, but they can just be signed by the chair and captioned as corrected.
Great. And if there are questions as we move along, feel free to contact Rick or Keeley or
Ramona,
anyone, if you have any questions about any of this. I find it sort of confusing, but...
Madam Chair, just so for my own edification, and this was never an issue in last session under your chairmanship, was if we have an amendment, you will distribute it to the committee?
Yes.
Okay, because that kind of is the threshold for if there was a minority report. I don't think we had one, did we?
We did have one.
We did have one? Okay,
uh-huh.
Okay, I'm
we
sorry.
Did.
But that would be the threshold to include it, because it's... I don't expect that we're going to be in that 24-hour time period.
Yeah.
This is not the committee where that happens. That's
right.
A rules
right.
committee.
Okay. But if that does become a problem, we'll take a recess. Whatever we need to do, we'll
right.
take
and that's
care
part of
the
no surprises
right.
thing, which is, yeah.
Right. We'll work together. Yes, Representative Cowan.
As we talk about that, I think that what's important to recognize as well is the value of having that conversation, because so often, and we particularly found in this committee, that as we discuss what might potentially lead to a minority report, if we didn't have an opportunity to converse about it, we may very well be able to make adaptations in the bill that we're discussing so that we can all come to consensus. And that's something that happened a great deal in this committee. And so I think we need to, there's a little bit of concern about some of those changes that have been made, and I think we need to look at the value in it, making sure that we're all aware of where the concerns are and how we might adapt things to make them work better.
Great. I agree. Thank you.
That's good.
Any other comments?
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 16th, 2009.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 1-16-09. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Van Orden?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. Thank you all very much. I wondered if we were going to have a party line vote between aye and yes.
What is your preference?
I apologize. I didn't mean to start.
Started it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's Maurer.
All right.
Perhaps Madam Chair could tell us her preference.
No, it doesn't matter to me. I just thought it was interesting. And I think in the future, Zach, I'm going to ask that the roll not always start with Van Orman, that we'll just go back and forth. Maybe we'll go down, just go different ways, so people aren't always in a position of having to be the last vote or the first vote. So I just want to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we will open up the informational hearing on presentation on expectations of challenges for the local public health department. Is their capacity. One of the things I forgot to mention about what is great about this committee is that you will meet some wonderful people, both staff from state agencies and from the advocates from different agencies, as well as the consumers of the services that Human Services provide. So that's one of the great things about this committee. So thank you very much for coming all today. And do we have a panel coming up? Please come up. And I'm going to let you decide on what order you want to proceed. And I just want to remind you that you need to state your name, please. And if it's a strange name, please spell it. I mean, that's terrible. I'm
good morning, Thomas.
Thank you.
Thomas, your name is here. You don't need to spell it.
If my name is on there, I won't need to spell it. Good morning, members of the committee. Chair Tomei, my name is Thomas Ashenbrenner. I'm the president of the Northwest Health Foundation. I'm also an appointee to the Governor's Public Health Advisory Board and have the honor currently of serving as chair of that board. I should also state for this record that I am a proud constituent of Representative Tomei's as well. And I really want to...
No, that's a conflict right there.
conflicts are never a problem as long as you acknowledge them. Thank you, Representative Olson. I really appreciate your taking the time to bring public health to the front of this conversation before this committee. This is very important because as you are doing other things in your committee work, not only here, but in all of your legislative work this session, you may be talking about Head Start. You may be talking about community colleges. You'll be talking a lot about economic development in this state. You will be talking about health reform in this state, as you are all aware. You know, what is important is each and every one of these areas affects the public's health and touches a lot of the work that the people that are here today are going to tell you about. So, my role is to talk a little bit about the frame of public health and tell you about some resources and some information that we are gathering. Others will tell you more about the public health system at the local level and some of the advocacy groups. And as I said, I want to frame my comments from the perspective of the Northwest Health Foundation. For those of you who aren't aware, Northwest Health Foundation is an independent charitable foundation that exists here only for the benefit of the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington. Our goal is to advance the health of the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington. And we are blessed many times over that we have our own assets. We are not financially beholden to anybody. And that makes a very big difference in the work that we do and how we do it and how we share our information. So our goal areas that we are working on there are in the area of access to care for and health reform, in public health and obesity prevention in the state of Oregon, and health workforce reform. And many of you may know of the work that we have done to help restructure nursing education in this state over the last 7 years. And I think we've made some very good progress. This legislative session, as I mentioned, you will be engaged in a great deal of conversation and debate over the economic future of the state, debate over health care reform, and you'll be asked to look at legislation to reduce or contain the cost of health care, and you will be pressured from many sides on how to pay for these changes. The debate that you will not hear, and that we are hopeful that you will bring the lens to this conversation, is how the protection, prevention, and response of the capacity of our public health system affects all of these conversations. You know, it has been said many times that you can rearrange all of the dollars in health care and add all the money you want to health care, and you will not improve the health of the people of the community if you don't have a strong public health system. And several years ago, many of you know Susan Allen when she came to be the Director of Public Health for the state of Oregon. When Susan came here, my reflection to her, my first comment to her was, Susan, you have a really strong group of public health professionals at the local level and at the state level to help you. But they are very much better than we deserve in Oregon. And the reason is that public health is one of the most underfunded resources in this state and yet affects so very, very much of what it is that we do. So I'll start by saying that we are 40th in the country in our support of public health. So when we recognized this disparity in resources at Northwest Health Foundation, 3 years ago, we began a public-private partnership with the Division of Public Health and the Oregon Public Health Commission to look at public policies and perceptions and public perception around public health, recognizing that we need to start working with people in communities to help them understand the role of public health in order to give each of you the support to carry forth that support as part of the work that you're going to be doing. We've conducted a fair amount of polling over the last 2 years, and we've also been doing some research. I want to say that our polling, just so you know, is all done by Davis Hibbets and Midge Hall, a group that many of you are probably familiar with in terms of polling in Oregon. So what we learned was that the community generally is very interested in those things that public health does and believes in them, but they don't know that it's public health. There is a disconnect between what public health does and what people believe should be available to them and in that frame of what is public health. 70% of Oregonians believe in community-based wellness and prevention efforts to improve the community's health. 64%, and this is something we have had in every one of the polls we've had, 64% believe government has a role in improving their community's health and that government programs should be improved or enhanced. People are telling us this over and over again. This is not a community that says, you know, we got to do it on our own. They're saying government has a responsibility. When we polled people about what was important to them that their local public health department should be doing for them, 80% believed that their local public health departments should be out there investigating health hazards in the community. That the 75% thought that enforcing laws and regulation that protect the community's health and safety was important. And 80% thought that information and education on health issues was important. And so we're getting, the community says, we need government to be playing this role in order to protect us. It doesn't work to say, you're on your own. It doesn't work. Consistent with this work, in our most recent poll, and this is no surprise to any of you, people who identified themselves, and I should say this is out of December 2008, middle-income people, people who identified themselves as middle-income, identified that they were in considerable economic, or that they were either having more economic distress than they had ever experienced before, or they were very fearful that in the near future that they would be experiencing economic distress. The flip side of that piece of information that we found is that these individuals also were saying they are now more concerned about the economic distress that others are experiencing. It is a time that we can come together as a community and address some of these issues. Another area where we are trying to add value in the conversation is in commissioned research. For example, we commissioned the study that was released a year ago on the economic impact of tobacco tax on low-income Oregonians. You know, you may remember that was one of the issues raised in the ballot measure, and we actually did the study that demonstrated something quite counter to what the public was being told. We have two additional studies, and at some point, if this committee wishes to find out more, we'd be glad to share them with you. The impact of obesity on the rising medical spending in Oregon from 1998 to 2005. That study is just about ready to be released. And a second study that will be out shortly is estimating the revenues and public health impact of a soda tax in Oregon. Northwest Health Foundation will prepare white papers as needed to address how we can advance a comprehensive system for public health in Oregon. And we will monitor opportunities at the federal and national level, national funder level, on how we can bring more resources to Oregon to help us grow and develop our ailing infrastructure. Likewise, the Public Health Advisory Board is doing a lot of work that it has traditionally not done. And one of the things that I'm really proud of is that there is a subcommittee that is actively working on addressing the issue of how can we develop a strong business case for public health in Oregon, and that we will use as a basis of engaging the business community in conversations around public health. Within this framework, we know that public health is only part of the essential conversations that you are going to be having this session. And as I think that it's important that you know that all of us here are very supportive of the concepts that are coming out in House Bill 2009 for health reform in Oregon. And we recognize that if that work is going to be successful, it is going to require that we have a strong system and a strong infrastructure for public health in Oregon. That the economic provisions that are being developed for that particular piece of legislation cannot be successful without public health. You know, we can't succeed in any of these endeavors if we don't change some of the thinking among our public. We have been a very self-centered society for a long time. And I think that it's important that we acknowledge and begin the process of just articulating that if we are going to be successful as a society, we are going to have to start coming together, working together, supporting each other, and working for the common good, not for the individual gain and not for the individual wealth accumulation. One of the leaders that I work with says, we are at a very critical time in our social development. We may not have much longer the opportunity to choose between community or chaos in our society. And I take those words very much to heart. So I will tell you, I will work as hard as I can for community. And I think many of us, on the other hand, are pretty optimistic. We are at a very optimistic point in our time. And we feel that there are good opportunities out there. And I want you to know that we at Northwest Health Foundation and the advocates that are in this room will be vigilant to seize those opportunities as they come forward. And in honor of the upcoming holiday of Martin Luther King Jr., I really want to acknowledge, while there are many good phrases and words from Reverend King, the ones that I think are most relevant today for me and for this committee is when he said, "What self-centered people have torn down, other centered people can build up." And I want us to think of that as we go through not only today but this session, and want you to know that we stand ready to support you in your work and hope that you will call upon us as you have needs for information and data that will assist you in your decision making. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ashenbrenner. Any questions of this?
Yes, one.
And this is your handout.
No.
No. Okay.
That is Kathleen's handout.
Well, maybe I should wait for her. But yes. I think you can answer it, Thomas. I have a question about the, this talks about the obesity prevention, tobacco prevention, and
yes.
public health, that whole paradigm. We all know prevention's really hard to prove. But is there anything going on now that will help us sell, if you will, the concept of prevention, putting our money into prevention action instead of just treatment? I mean, I know we have to do treatment too, but is there anything happening that how we can, when we make our prioritization decisions in this committee and in other areas of our public policy, that we can bring to that discussion that will make the case for us?
First of all, I would say that, you know, it takes a lot of work and money to create a non-event. And that's what you're really talking about. You are trying to create non-events. The only way you can measure the effectiveness of creating a non-event is to monitor over a very long period of time those spaces, places where prevention interventions occurred. And you could record the non-event versus those places where those interventions did not occur and what the rate and experience was. I can tell you that the cost of creating non-events is very, very much less than the cost of treating events once they occur. But the longitudinal studies are there, and I think the data does exist. And we can prepare, and if there are specific questions, we can provide that.
Okay, that's what I was going to say, is if we can use you as a conduit
Absolutely.
For information.
Okay, and we'll run studies if we can't find them.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Tomei. But is that not what public health is all about, prevention? Mm-hmm. Isn't that why it exists?
Yes. That is why public health exists, and it's why we advocate for it. Is there more to your question?
No,
than that?
I guess I'm trying to communicate that I'm saying that for me, public health is about prevention.
Right.
That's why we put it into place, is to prevent the catastrophic events that we experienced years and years and years ago.
Absolutely. It is both prevention and it is response, because we have to think about the role. It's the monitoring, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At the risk of opening a can of worms, let me say to you that disease monitoring is a very important part of it. And we say, oh, gee, we've done that for years. It's old hat, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to put out that I am deeply concerned about some things that are happening in Ashland, and that, you know, 28% of the children in Ashland are not immunized,
right.
And if there is not monitoring of measles outbreaks, whooping cough outbreaks down there, very soon we are going to see some big problems. And we think of that as kids, but remember, it is these diseases also affect seniors. And what is Ashland? It's a high retirement area. And so I'm saying that we really need to be paying attention to that. Now, we've got to figure out why is it that there is such a high concentration of people in Ashland who feel that they wish to claim their religious exemption. But work with that. But I also think that people who do have their, who are taking their kids in, or more importantly, the people who can't be immunized for legitimate health reasons, have to send their kids to schools with a large number of non-immunized kids, which is creating greater risk of disease. Are we willing to spend 20 cents to get the immunization done? Or do we want to spend thousands and tens of thousands of dollars in treating diseases that may be the consequences of that? I mean, these are our choices, and I think we need to be clear about what our society wants.
Thank you, Tom. All right, we're going to move on. I'm sorry, was there another question?
Yes.
Close to Ashland.
I am close to Ashland, and in pockets, in elementary schools, it's over 60% non-immunized. And in fact, the federal government is paying people to come and relay their experiences on why they don't immunize their children. But I don't think it's a religious question. It's a political question. And you know, I think your question about prevention and how you can say it doesn't work, the non-event, all you got to do is look at our water system and our sanitation systems and say, well, if you don't have it, it doesn't take, you know, it's not a rocket surgeon to figure out that we're going to have some significant problems soon. So I think those are two areas of public health that are huge, and I think as we are get more sophisticated, it gets more complicated to address these non-events because we've addressed some of the bigger ones. But the other thing you said, Thomas, and if I may call you Thomas,
by all means,
is House Bill 2009, and I'm wondering if people have actually they say. Yesterday was a news conference, and it will be discussed ad nauseum. But have they actually read it? And I'm concerned that people are just clearly overarching, say, yes, I support 2009, and really have they read the details of the bill? And because there are some parts of it that gravely concern me, not from just a tax issue or, you know, some... but really fundamental changes in our democracy about the ability to commit conspiracy, the ability to create monopolies, and that's overt language in the bill that really concerns me. That's just a comment. So
okay.
I'm not asking.
I won't respond.
Thank you. I appreciate
that very much.
But I especially
want to
know about rocket surgeon.
It's kind of an amalgamation of the, you know, you don't have to be a brain surgeon or rocket scientist. It's a
like laser.
I just have one more. Thomas and I, you can call me Debbie too. So, what your group's doing, do you work with other groups, similar groups around the world, and what they're doing? I see a nodding in the back there.
That's my staff.
Okay.
Representative Boone, the answer is yes. We pay a lot of attention to what's happening nationally. We are a very active part of a group called Grantmakers in Health, and there are several committees that exist within that group, which are the CEO working groups on public health, the CEO groups working group on access. So I work with, there's 243 foundations like ours around the country. Robert Wood Johnson, you know, California Endowment, the big ones, people that have many, many more times more money than the rest of us. But we are working together. We share information. When I'm talking about doing some of these commission studies, the two of the studies were done by a professor of economics out of Chicago. Another one was done by a professor out of Emory University, so that we use leaders from around the country to conduct these studies. I mean, we have very good people here in Oregon. I don't diminish that at all. But some studies we do here with local people, some we do with national people. People, depending upon the nature of the study, so we want the right information on the page here, and that's what we're working for.
I guess
follow up.
Thank you. My point is, thank you for that too. But so that when you do your work, maybe you're not duplicating another study that will create the same data, but you're even maybe expanding it or going the next step that maybe another foundation couldn't do or another country couldn't find or didn't have the money for. But you keep in that. Somebody checks that.
Representative Boone, the answer is yes, we do. For example, the study on the economic impact of obesity in Oregon. This is a study that has been in its shell done in several other communities around the country by the same group that we hired. What we did and what we have found consistently is important for the Oregon psyche is that when we report information, most of the time people in Oregon want us to report on what does it look like in Oregon. And so while we take the national studies and we'll often go back and hire those researchers, we want to know, what does it mean in Oregon? And is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, and I guess you hear about when, and I know you don't ask us for money, but there are a lot of groups who do and ask for our support and advocacy, and we'll be, we're always in the position of trying to use our money in the most efficient way. And so if you think of giving money to three different groups and they all end up with the same study.
Right.
It doesn't go far.
Chair Tomei, if I may just make a quick response. One of the hallmarks of Northwest Health Foundation and the work that we do is that we are building collaborations so that I share exactly the concern you raise, Representative Boone. In fact, have said to several groups, if you don't work together, we can't fund you. But one of the things that we do is that we build on community collaborations of people of like-minded interest. Work, and we've been very successful at this, coming out with a consensus strategy for the overall approach to whatever the issue is, recognizing that many times these individual groups have a piece of that strategy that they wish to promote, but it is in support then of the overall strategy and outcome. If there is an accomplishment of our foundation, I'm most proud of it, is that ability to bring together community groups.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Mary Lou?
Good morning, Chair Tomei and representatives. It is indeed a pleasure to be here. I'm Mary Lou Henrich. I am the Executive Director of Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute. We are a small, independent, not-for-profit public health organization that is very thankful to the Northwest Health Foundation, which helps support some of our work. We get a variety of sources of funding, but we are indeed independent and can speak out on supporting public health in the broad sense at the state level, at the local level, and at independent community-based organizations and bringing them together. All of them are important. And what we try to do is to improve the public's health by looking at possible policy that can be done. And I think our kind of claim to fame that some of you know about is that working together and providing some leadership that got House Bill 2650 passed last session that changes the nutrition standards for what foods and beverages can be sold in Oregon schools. Basically, it was to get the junk food out and to make it so that the environment for kids is easier for them to make a healthy choice. So we're really looking at how do we help create environments where we live, work, play, pray, study, all the ways that we lead our lives, which isn't getting up every morning necessarily and thinking, how can I be healthy today? I mean, that is kind of maybe in the back of some people's minds. Mine maybe more than some others. My family thinks I'm kind of a nut on it. But overall, most people, we get up in the morning thinking, well, I'm going to have to bring home the paycheck. I've got to worry about getting the kids to their soccer practice. All those things. But how can we help make the environments where we live our lives ones that support us as we try to make individual healthy decisions? And we, too, work with a lot of organizations. We support, we really were created, I think, in early 2000 to actually be a non-governmental voice, but supporting the work of local and state government to work effectively to improve the public's health. I think one of the things that, as Thomas spoke, and we all collectively work together with the Coalition of Local Health Officials representing local health departments will be here speaking through Kathleen and Dr. Mel Cohn as the director of the state public health, and the foundation and us, saying, how can we create a system that allows us to help Oregonians be healthy as we can be? And as we do this, we struggle a lot with how to explain to people what is public health, because it is the non-event. It is preventing disease. And so it's not out there. It's I have a dear friend whose son died of cancer a few years back, and Keegan was a wonderful young kid who struggled for a long time, and at various points throughout various chemos, he was bald and in a wheelchair. And Colleen said to me, Mary Lou, you can't put Keegan on the front of the public health brochure that pulls at the heartstrings, that says, you know, donate to this cause, because kind of how do you put something you're trying to prevent on the front of that? You know, is it a water spigot? We have talked about that, because I'll say to people, they say, well, I don't think public health affects my life. That's that poor people's stuff, isn't it? And I go, no, it's that you turn on that water faucet in the morning and you don't have to think about, am I going to get sick today? Because I turned on the water faucet and chose to take a drink of water. It is that real behind-the-scenes action. And I think on communicable disease, we've done a fairly good job, and Kathleen will talk about an assessment that's been done that we actually helped a little bit in the facilitation of, that really shows that public health departments at the local level, in concert with their state technical assistance people, have done a good job where there's been some funding to do prevention. And it's been heavily around the communicable disease. So right now, we don't really daily, except when you talk about immunization levels and things. I mean, this can get out of whack pretty easily. But it's really around the chronic diseases that we haven't had funding. We haven't really put the model into effect as effectively as it could be around the things that are really killing Oregonians. And the things that are killing Oregonians are heart disease, diabetes, things that are being driven by the obesity epidemic, and smoking. So we're as an organization trying to work with our partners who work in the government, our partners at the foundation, our partners in community-based organizations around the state, to really articulate more clearly what it is that public health is, can do, and to build support and advocacy on policy issues. And our organization, because public health is broad and we're small, is focusing right now on the childhood obesity epidemic. And we applaud this committee for your work last year on the bill that helps breastfeeding moms, because breastfeeding is, I have become convinced, the key to prevention of chronic disease at so many levels, and the data just keeps mounting. So the work that you did to have the workplace accommodation bill and have Oregon be the leader in this really I can't thank you enough, and on behalf of the citizens of Oregon, I really want to thank you for what you've done. So we'll be looking at other things like menu labeling, making calories and nutrition information available to people so as we choose and try to make healthy choices that we know what we're doing when we go into chain restaurants. So we work on a variety of things, but what I'm here really today to say to you is your local public health departments across this state are absolutely underfunded, but ready and willing, and I heard Gordon Fultz from AOC yesterday say they are shovel ready for the stimulus package, for whatever stimulus we can get to them, to focus in their community and work with and provide that accountable place. Because I'm all for collaborations and work that is just good citizen groups working on things. I have nothing against that. But I have seen in my career, and I've been at this 40 years now, I've just seen a lot of things that start and kind of there's a lot of energy, but they drift away as people kind of go on to something else. And if they're not connected somehow to an accountable government, it just doesn't continue to happen. Good things happen, but they disappear. So I'm a strong supporter, and I will claim my conflict. I worked for Multnomah County Health Department for many years. And I believe, however, that I've seen across this state what local health departments can do when they're given a tiny bit of funding. So I know you're not the Ways and Means Committee or the Revenue Committee, but just kind of we're trying today to set the stage to talk about the partnerships, the collaborations, and the need to have a strong public health system in Oregon. And we at Community Health Partnership stand ready to continue working with you, work with all of you who are new to the legislature, and call on us at any time, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hendricks. Any questions of this presenter? All right. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Chair Tomei, representatives, thank you for inviting us this morning. My name is Kathleen O'Leary, and I am the public health administrator for Washington County, here today as the vice chair of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the capacity assessment that I believe that you all have that we did here in Oregon. In fall of 2007, CLO looked at its organization, did some organizational development, and developed some strategies going into the next several years of where they wanted to go and how would they know if they got there. One of those strategies was to conduct a statewide capacity assessment for the local piece of the public health system. What we wanted to know was, where are we on the map? Are we fully functional? And if not, where are the areas that we needed additional investment in local public health? We looked to national standards because in addition to looking to meet the accountability standards that we have here in Oregon, we wanted to make sure that we are consistent with our national public health partners. So we looked to what are referred to as the 10 essential services or functions. And if you'll bear with me as I read them briefly for you, to monitor community health status, to diagnose and investigate community health problems and hazards, to inform, educate, and empower people about health issues, to mobilize community partnerships, to develop policies and plans that support health efforts, to enforce laws and regulations, to assure that health care is provided, to assure a competent public health workforce, to evaluate the effectiveness, accessibility, and quality of health services, and to research for new insights and innovative solutions. The 10 essential services functions are really important for a number of reasons. They are the basis of the definition of a fully functional local health department that has been developed by the National Association of County and City Health Officials. They're also the foundation for the movement to accredit local health departments. In 2011, we expect that movement around accreditation of local health departments to be implemented, and we further expect that while it will start out as voluntary, that federal and other private and foundation funding will probably be tied to successful accreditation of local health departments. So we really wanted to make sure that we were positioning ourselves in terms of being responsive to our accountability, to being consistent with local and national standards, and to be poised for investment and revenue from a variety of sources. We worked with Community Health Partnership and with the Association of Oregon Counties. We wanted some independence around this process so that we could look at the data and the findings that were produced and know that they were not entirely self-serving. We started with an in-depth survey that was actually developed by NACHO, again consistent with the 10 essential services, and it's easier to work on a standardized tool that someone has put together. We tweaked it a little bit for Oregon, and I think one of the most impressive things is that we had 100% participation of all the county health departments here in Oregon. Now, for those of you that have worked on research or surveys or organizational development, I think that's really phenomenal to have 100% participation and engagement. We worked not only through the survey, but Community Health Partnership conducted regional focus groups, so like counties came together to look at the data that were produced from the survey and really dig deep into that. Were we all thinking the same thing? What does that mean? What would that look like in your health department? What does that look like in your neighbor's health department? And really spent half days chewing to some extent on the data from the survey to make sure that we were adding the qualitative pieces, we were adding the understanding to that. So what did we find? We found that overall meaning across all 34 county health departments and across all 10 essential services, we're at 57% capacity toward fully functional local health departments here in Oregon. That's a 43% gap in capacity. Remembering that that's important because that affects our ability or reflects our inability to perform those 10 essential services, which compromises efficiency and effectiveness of our prevention efforts. So looking at where we have capacity and where we don't is really important. There was not one 10 essential service that we were at 100% capacity, but Mary Lou is exactly right. The places where we had dedicated funding, we looked much better. For example, diagnosing and investigating health issues were at 74% capacity overall statewide, much less gap. The areas that have no dedicated funding for public health and yet are key pieces of public health practice are monitoring health status, mobilizing partnerships, evaluating health services, let me say that one again, evaluating health services, core piece of public health, place where there's not dedicated funding, developing policies and plans, all of these hover at 50% capacity or less. So they're core pieces of what we need to be able to provide to have a healthy public, and we do not, in fact, have the capacity to do at this particular juncture. The themes that were generated from this work, local public health is spread too thin. Categorical funding, our federal funding, and for which we are grateful, but it is categorical. It comes with significant streams and strengths. You will use this money for, and it's a prescribed set of services or activities. Categorical funding limits our practice options. There are a lot of functions that we need to be able to provide to Oregon residents that categorical funding will never get us to. More dynamic health education capacity is needed. More community outreach capacity is needed. Workforce recruitment, training, retention needs to be addressed. And we need good tools. We need the data and the technology that allows us to be efficient, move forward, and have quick access to reliable data. So those are the themes that were generated from our study. So why should we care? Well, for one thing, every Oregon resident should benefit from the same high-quality public health services. And in fact, ORS 431.416 delineates the five services that Oregonians should be able to rely on and local public health should be able to provide. The first one is epidemiology and control of preventable diseases. Remember, there's a 25% capacity gap in that one identified by our work. Parent and child health services, collect and report health statistics, environmental health, and health education and referral. So, all residents of Oregon deserve high-quality public health. I'm very pleased that you chewed a little bit about prevention and does it work, because I believe that it does work. I believe that if you look at public health interventions over the last century, think about seatbelts, think about immunizations, which you did discuss, think about bicycle helmets, think about back-to-sleep campaigns and clean water. Think also about a comprehensive approach to tobacco control. When the tobacco prevention and education program was fully funded in Oregon, we in fact have very good data that says a comprehensive approach works. And while I don't have those graphs and data here for you today, I can tell you very clearly that a comprehensive approach to public health issues, including those ones that have that personal responsibility piece, like smoking, like good nutrition, like exercise, and I'm not here to say that that is a personal responsibility. I'm here to say it deserves a comprehensive approach in order for public health prevention to be effective. So that balance of how do we think about the health and wellness of our communities, good public health prevention, balancing that with medical intervention, and really looking at prevention as one way to decrease the demand on medical services. Healthy people spend less money on medical services, so I do believe that prevention works. And why local health departments? Mary Lou also mentioned we are accountable. We are accountable to the public in statute, in rule, and by the way that we are organized with county government. We report to local boards of county commissioners who themselves are also accountable to the public. So we are that reliable piece that is there for a variety of pieces that is really charged with the health of the community and with the accountability to the community for those health services and interventions. So what do we recommend? CLO recommends increased local staffing. There's just not enough good folk in those health departments to be able to provide the services. Folks that are there are talented. They are exceptional staff. There's just not enough of them. Flexible funding streams. In order to be responsive to our communities, what will work in Washington County will probably look different in Baker County, or in Union County, or in Lake County. We need to be able to be locally responsive to our communities and have funding streams that allows us to do that. We need to invest in quality assurance. Just because it sounds like a good idea doesn't mean that it in fact works. We need to be able to evaluate our services, evaluate them with a strenuous process, and make sure that we are providing and investing in interventions that in fact do work. We need robust training. What we responded to last century are different than what we are required to respond to in this century, and we need to keep our workforce competent and well-trained and nimble to the changing health environment. We need well-funded, tailored, local, dynamic health education. We need to be able to engage with our communities about improving their health. We need to be able to invest in thorough health assessment, community health assessment.
Again, I'm going to encourage you to. We've got several more people
okay.
to present, and we have to leave here at about 10 minutes before 11. We have a floor session. Am I correct about that? 10, not 11. Thank you.
Thank you. I have two more things, and then I will close. Thank you very much, however. We need to invest in leadership development. Good public health depends on good public health leaders, and we need to invest in those technology and data systems that allows us to have tools that we can work with easily to be responsive and nimble. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any one quick question that somebody's just dying to ask? Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thank you. Us all now.
Sorry?
You scared us all.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that we're very fortunate to have Kathleen here today. She originally came
I'm going to let this group go and our next group come up while Representative Boone's talking.
I remember her from Clatsop County, and now I represent a tiny piece of Washington County, so I can still claim a little bit. So great expertise over the years.
Oh, I can see that. Thank you. Hello. Welcome back.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the acting director of the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services, which is our state health department here in Oregon, and I'm also the state health officer. Those of you who I have had the pleasure of working with in past sessions, it's really an honor to be here this morning and help you kick off your work this session. This committee has really provided some terrific leadership around the issues we care about, and I know Chair Tomei is very, very committed to this work. So I'm really pleased to be here this morning.
Mr. Cohn, before we proceed, do we have a third person who is going to be testifying today? There were three more names on the list.
I think Kathleen replaced Dave Houghton.
Okay, so I just want to know how much I need to worry. Okay.
Okay. Stress. We're working with it.
Please continue.
Those of you with whom I haven't had the pleasure of speaking yet, I really look forward to talking with you and working with you through the session. What I'm going to do today is to give you a little bit of a bigger picture from the state view about what some of what you've heard already means. The assessment that Claude did is really a terrific step forward. In fact, several months ago, I've been working in public health in Oregon for about 10 years now, and several months ago, Bruce Goldberg, who's the director of the department, came to me and said, Mel, would you be willing to step in as the acting director? One of the reasons I was interested in doing this was because of the incredible work that we've had as a system, not only the support from our advocates, but the work between local and state public health that I think really positions us to do some important things for the citizens of Oregon. So that assessment is a terrific step forward, but some of the things that Kathleen talked about for those not immersed in public health on a daily basis can sound a little bit abstract. So what I want to do is put some specific issues out there that, from my perspective, affect every community in this state, and I know you will be hearing legislation and debating about investing funding as well in things that touch each of these issues. So I thought that would be a nice complement to the wonderful presentations we've already had this morning. So let me start, and I'm going to talk to you about four issues, and at the top of my list, far and away, is tobacco use. We have made some terrific progress around tobacco in this state, in large part due to the leadership of this legislature. Chair Tomei has been very important in that, as well as others of you. But still, we have about almost 20% of Oregon adults who smoke. Now, that's way down from where we were, say, 50 years ago when 50% of adults smoked. And while there is a general trend in the U.S. towards decrease in tobacco use, our program here in Oregon has been extremely effective. After Representative Boone was asking about data showing effectiveness, when our tobacco program started in 1997, this was funded primarily by dollars from ballot measure 44 that was a 30 cent per pack tax on cigarettes. 3 cents of that 30 cents, only 3 cents, went towards our prevention program. And with those dollars, in the ensuing years, we saw twice the drop in tobacco use here in Oregon that we had seen nationwide. I think those are among the best outcomes of any program in state government that I've ever seen. Now, what happened, of course, is that we have had fluctuations in our funding. And one of the things that we know is that our success is directly tied to how much we're funded. In the 2003 session, in a situation that frankly gives me a little quake when I think about the fiscal issues you all are going to be facing this session, it was another very tight budget picture. Our funding was first initially cut altogether by the legislature, and then at the end of the session was restored in a small amount. Now, the net effect of this was devastating to our program, and what we saw in the subsequent years was really a leveling off of the progress we had been making, and in some cases, for example, in smoking among pregnant women, which is a very serious problem for not only for the women themselves, but for the kids, increases in low birth weight, very, very expensive for our healthcare system as well. We actually saw an increase in the number of pregnant women who were smoking. We have had restoration of our funding back to the levels where we were and have had a little bit of an increase, but we are still, we know this not only from our own experience here in Oregon, but from experience in other states, that the effects that we get, our effectiveness is very closely tied to how well we are funded. So I know that's going to be an issue you all are going to be talking about. The tobacco tax issue is going to come up. We know that the tobacco tax itself is a very important deterrent to smoking, particularly to young people starting to smoke. They're very sensitive to increases in price. So that's in and of itself an important tool for you to consider using, and also an important revenue generator, hopefully for some prevention issues. So tobacco still accounts for about 20% of the deaths that occur in Oregon are tobacco-related. It's still a major killer, but we know how to fix this if we can get our programs on track and get them appropriately funded. The next issue I want to talk about is number two in the pantheon. Mary Lou, I think it was, mentioned the issues of chronic disease, and that's obesity. We are used to thinking ourselves and priding ourselves here in Oregon on being ahead of the curve, and this is one area where, unfortunately, we have been ahead of the curve, but it's not an area we should be terribly proud of, unfortunately. Oregon was the first state on the West Coast to have 20% of adults report their weight in the obese range. And we have been joined by some other partners in that now, but those numbers continue to increase, and they're really of grave concern. One of the studies that Thomas referred to, he talked about a national study that looked at the impact of obesity on healthcare costs. This study looked at the increase in healthcare costs. I believe it's from 1997 through 2001. And showed that in that interval, more than a quarter of the increase in healthcare spending was attributable to an increased prevalence of obesity. Think of what you could do around healthcare or other priorities that you have if a quarter of the money we were spending on healthcare was freed up. So we know since 2001, of course, prevalence rates of obesity have continued to increase, and I expect that the impact on our healthcare system has continued to grow as well. And I will tell you that as you think about healthcare reform, no matter how creative you're going to be about changing the way the system is configured or how it's funded or what incentives are in place, if you don't address the drivers of healthcare, and that's a public health function to do that, if you don't do that, the business model you have is just not going to be sustainable. And there's good data to back up that assertion. What might local health departments have to do with all of this, you might say. And I wanted to give you one small example of some work we've been doing with the business community around worksite wellness. There's very good research data out there that shows that worksite wellness programs, and these are a variety of incentives and ways of changing the worksite environment to support healthy eating and physical activity, that those programs have a terrific return on investment. Depending on the specifics of the worksite wellness program that's in place and also on the research studies involved, they're in the $3 to $8 return on investment range. So if you invest a dollar, you get $3 to $8 back in a relatively short period of time. depending on the outcome, 1 to 5 years worth of time. So I think that's a really important message to get out to the business community. And there are a few businesses that have started to work in this arena. But think about what a local health department could do if they were connecting with their local businesses, sharing this information, providing technical assistance on how you do this, linking up these local businesses with each other. This is not a regulatory move. This is a kind of community education and community mobilization kind of activity. This could have a tremendous impact, turbocharging the kind of economic development that we all want to see in our communities. And that, I think, is just one example of one of the ways that we need to approach this obesity issue, and that having a sound local public health infrastructure can help do that. The next area I want to talk about just very, very briefly is suicide prevention. Unfortunately, here in Oregon, we have high rates of suicide. Roughly two-thirds of our violent deaths here in Oregon are due to suicide. If you think about the infrastructure that we have in place around another violent death problem, homicide, we have a whole law enforcement and criminal justice system that tries to deal with that, and some prevention activities hopefully as well, and compare that to what's done with suicide, I think this is a problem that is largely unacknowledged and unaddressed. In part, this is a mental health problem, and there are important things one-on-one that need to happen in the mental health system to address suicide, better treating of depression and so forth. But there's a lot that needs to happen out in the community to support those efforts, to reduce the stigma around seeking mental health treatment, to hook people who are at highest risk for suicide up with the treatment that they need, that really are classic kinds of public health functions, and I think public health has a huge amount to contribute in this arena. And it's an area where we have done some work with a variety of partners in the community, but haven't had a big increase in funding really with which to really take that to scale. So that's an area where I would be happy to talk more about, and I hope I'll have an opportunity at some point this session to talk about that. The last area I'm going to talk about is one...
Dr. Cohn, just a minute. Representative Olson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Dr. Cohn, I am interested in suicide. And do you know where we fit in the nation for that?
Representative Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, we are... It varies a little bit year to year, mm-hmm. but we're about 10th in the nation these days.
Okay, thank you.
And that's... Being higher is not good.
Right.
No.
I get that.
Yeah.
We're going to follow up with, continue with this and see if there are questions
Thank you.
Later. You're welcome.
Okay. The last area I want to talk about is climate change. And you might be asking, why is a public health person talking about climate change? So let me explain why I'm going to talk about that. Most of the discussion around climate change has really been focused on what can we do to prevent climate change. And, you know, there are a variety of issues that you all will be engaged in debating this session that are geared at addressing that. The health system does have a role to play in that. We are probably a fairly energy-intensive, a fairly greenhouse gas-intensive sector of the economy. But the public health piece of this, I think, is particularly important in what we're going to do to adapt to the changes that climate change is going to bring to us. We know that even if we are able to find the perfect solution to preventing the increase in greenhouse gases, there's been enough production already that we are going to see some fairly fundamental changes in our environment, and our environment affects our health. Some of the areas that I think we are going to be seeing some important changes in that I want to talk about, there's really two that I'm going to highlight this morning. The first is extreme weather events. So this is heat waves, extreme precipitation events, and forest fires. These are all things that have very profound public health impacts, and the public health system needs to be ahead of that curve in terms of planning for communities to respond when those events occur. We haven't yet figured out how to prevent extreme precipitation events, but we do know that when flooding occurs, there's a lot we can do to protect particularly our most vulnerable citizens, and that preparedness responsibility is largely a public health one, with, of course, help from a very wide range of partners. The other area that I want to talk about, Thomas alluded to this issue about disease tracking. The changes in the environment are going to cause serious changes in terms of vectors of communicable diseases. Some of you may remember the Four Corners outbreak of hantavirus that occurred some years ago. Well, what happened in that outbreak was essentially that there was a very high amount of rainfall. The rainfall produced a very lush harvest of pinion nuts, those little pine nuts we all love to eat, and deer mice, that's their primary source of food. So when there were all these pinion nuts around, there was an explosion in the population of deer mice. Now, you may think deer mice are very cute. Unfortunately, they also happen to be vectors for hantavirus, and this explosion in the population meant that all of a sudden a whole lot more people got exposed to this virus and became very ill, many deaths. It was a very frightening time, this mystery virus that kind of appeared. The public health role in that, first of all, detecting that something new was happening there. That is a primary disease tracking and monitoring function that the public health system did. Then figuring out what on earth it was, again, that is a primary function that the public health system performs. So as climate change brings, I don't know exactly which pathogens are going to burst onto the horizon here in Oregon. I have a few educated guesses, but whether they're going to turn out to be true or not, I have to confess that they're pretty soft in terms of database. It's very hard to predict exactly what's going to emerge, but I'm quite confident there will be things that are going to emerge, and we need to have a system in place to detect them and to mount an appropriate response to protect our citizens when that happens. And that requires a functional public health system, particularly at the local level, where a lot of that first detection and tracking happens. So with that, I'm going to close. Thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to answer questions either now or in the future. My department is also a resource for you. We do a lot of the tracking and monitoring, and we have a lot of data that we can point you to if you have particular questions that are of interest. And thank you again for this opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cohn. And I will allow a question in just a second, but I want you to come back sometime. One of the things we haven't talked about recently, and there was a lot of talk about it when there was the bird flu that everybody was so concerned about, that sort of died down. But I think from that came the knowledge that there will someday be a flu, pandemic flu. And it's not if it will happen. The question is when it happens. What do we do? So I think we're going to ask you to come back to talk more about all of these issues that you just touched on today, and also talk about pandemic flu, if that still is an issue we need to be concerned about.
Chair Tomei, absolutely. Be my pleasure.
Thank you. Let's see. I think Representative Van Orman, and we're going to make these really quick.
I will try to have another speaker. Thank you, Representative Tomei. As a Head Start director, the 75% of the focus is on health. So we do a lot of work with families and children, and of course, obesity in Head Start is not a critical issue. Hunger is. And as a descendant of Irish people who left Ireland during the famine, one of the outstanding statements of that period of time is that the Irish women lost the capacity to cook anything but a potato. So in my work in Head Start, one of the things that's really very obvious is that the young people are becoming less knowledgeable about many things that affect their health and well-being. And I think that's a critical issue, is how are we going to educate? And I don't think it's just Head Start parents who don't know some of these basics. We had a research project with UCLA and Johnson & Johnson on helping parents use a resource book to identify what was going on with their child to reduce the use of the emergency room. We've got the stats to prove that, in fact, that worked.
Representative Van Orman, is there a question here?
Well, yes, because I'm going down to all of these factors that they've talked about. One of the big issues they've talked about is obesity and in wellness in the workplace. And we've had staff that we've done these things, but the major factor with most of the staff is stress. And what are we and when we talk about the suicide rate, because I think a lot of stress comes out in eating disorders. And so if we're going to talk about that, is that going to be part of the discussion?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, very briefly, absolutely. And the work that Head Start does is terrific. I think engaging the child care sector in obesity prevention issues is a very key area. I know Community Health Partnership is very interested in this as well, and our office at the state. I will tell you, we do not have a penny of state dollars invested in obesity prevention in this state currently. So, you know, that's something we hope is going to change, but it's very difficult to address that without any resources to do it. But it clearly, you're absolutely right, that is a very key problem. Stress is an important part of that and a variety of other factors as well.
And we will have Dr. Pohn come back again and address more thoroughly some of these issues.
Okay. Just briefly, too, I would like you to, when you do come back, Dr. Cohn, talk about how meth might be affecting some of these other issues that we've discussed today too, and what's happening, what we can do, and because I know that drug and alcohol treatment is down in many of the counties, and I think that that's something that public health is part of. So.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, absolutely. I would like to, if we do that, I definitely would want to bring my colleagues from the Addictions and Mental Health Division as well. They're key players in that.
And thank you for having that. And thank you for bringing that up. Thank you. And can that wait just a minute, Representative?
Yes,
great.
Ma'am.
Okay. Sorry to rush you, but we have about 13 minutes.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Chair Tomei and the committee, for having us this morning. I am Jenny Leonard. I'm the Umatilla County Public Health Administrator, and I will be brief. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what public health looks like at the local level and some of the issues that we have and that we face day-to-day just doing the down-in-the-dirt work. One of our major issues centers around our recruitment and retention of staff, qualified staff. Our clinics often put out recruitment for nurses, BSN-level nurses, and what we recruit are ADN-level. And while that's fantastic, BSN-level nurses are education-ready and can go to work in many of the programs that we have on the ground level and ready to roll out. In addition to that,
I apologize. You said BS for the audience, BSN versus, explain
okay.
what that is.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I should have said earlier, we're going to be trying to talk in words and not in letters.
Acronyms.
So please don't use acronyms.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and Representative, BSN is a Bachelor of Science nurse, and an ADN is an Associate Degree Nurse.
Thank you.
Okay. In addition to our recruitment, we have a real issue with retention of our staff. Area hospitals and medical clinics, as well as physicians, recruit our well-trained staff away from us, primarily due to wages. We're not able to meet the competitive wages that the outside public sector or private sector can pay that we are not able to. This leaves our department very vulnerable while we go back into the recruitment process, and we can spend months to years retraining staff, and there's a considerable cost associated with that retraining, as well as a very steep learning curve. Another issue that I'd like to bring up is the siloed funding that we have in public health. Our money is very restricted, and while one program may be fairly well-funded, another or its counterpart is not well-funded, and that's difficult for many folks to understand when we're delivering services, and it's difficult for our own staff to understand. Let me give you an example. In Umatilla County, one program that is woefully underfunded is our school-based health centers. Through the years, the grants have decreased, and while we have strong partnerships with our area hospitals and with our school district, and they actually do supply funding for those programs, our grants have decreased to a level that it looks quite possible that we won't have school-based health centers in Umatilla County due to the funding constraints. And finally, I'd like to draw your attention to our communicable disease program. This is an area that requires a high level of training. We're experts in our community for our physicians, our hospitals, and our residents. People call us when they want to know the answers, and they expect us to know the answers. This has become an issue when our communicable disease staff are pulled away to perform other duties due to the primary funding constraints. It's not uncommon for one of my staff to be an expert in one or two or even three area programs. Specifically, our communicable disease nurse not only works our communicable disease, but immunizations, sexually transmitted diseases, and HIV, along with the reportable diseases that he and she will deal with on a daily basis. A real good example of communicable disease issues would be a case of tuberculosis. It's very, very complicated. It requires a great deal of initial training and ongoing training to remain proficient and efficient in the treatment and diagnosis for our clients. Tuberculosis is not a regular occurrence in our county, and maintaining the staff with those levels of expertise is extremely difficult. So before I close, I'd like to ask three things of you. One, I would encourage you to read our CLO capacity assessment. It's put together by multiple smart people. It has some fantastic stories and analogies that really put public health at a level that is understandable and applicable. The second thing I'd ask you to do is to share what you learn in this capacity assessment with your colleagues. And if they don't have an assessment, let us know. We'd be happy to get more copies out. And finally, help us to make our public health system whole by supporting a strong public health system here in Oregon. So, I thank you for your time. If you have any additional questions of the panel, I'm sure we'd all be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. Yep. And we do have time for questions. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the information. Something that hasn't been touched on explicitly is, the influence of ethnicity in the population who's that's being dealt with. And I wonder if the studies have disaggregated the data by ethnicity, by income level, et cetera. And further, to what extent cultural issues are addressed in outreach programs by public health agencies. And further, and this is a really powerful interest of mine, in the development of the healthcare workforce, how successful are we at diversifying that workforce and taking workers who are perhaps doing direct care of patients and getting them trained to be health professionals and ideally then retaining them in those positions?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, thank you. That's a very interesting and important question. We do a lot of work around the term that we use to describe what you're talking about is health disparities. And just to give an example, in the tobacco realm, we know that in the African American community, smoking rates are about 1.5 times what they are in the general public. In Native Americans, we're over 2 times as high. And we do have some specific activities that are targeted in working with those communities to address that. The reasons for those disparities are complex. They often involve, frankly, very targeted marketing by the tobacco industry in a variety of ways. But what's powerful in changing those behaviors is changing the social norms around them. And so doing that in a way that is culturally competent, culturally resonant, is very, very important. One additional health disparity that I think particularly in the tobacco realm we've become very conscious of is the socioeconomic gradient and tobacco use. Low-income smokers smoke at about 3 times the rate of upper-income people. So, did I say that correctly? Low-income people, about 3 times the prevalence of tobacco use compared with higher-income people. And this, when you think about the fact that cigarettes are expensive, this is kind of astounding. A pack-a-day smoker, which is your average smoker, spends about $1,400 a year on tobacco. Well, if you don't have a lot of money, even if you do have a lot of money, that is a lot of money to be spending. But this is a highly addictive product, and we need to do what we can to work with that group and try to address that issue there. So that's something that we're very aware of and trying to address as best we can.
And on the workforce side,
do you want to?
Could you repeat the question? I apologize.
On the workforce side, our success at attracting a diverse pool of professionals.
Representative Tomei, representative. Yes, we have a wide and diverse work group. Currently, right now, I have a couple of clerical staff attending nursing school on the side. We also recruit bilingual staff because of our high Hispanic population in our community. At this point, have not been successful in recruiting for a nurse that's bilingual, so if you know anyone, we're always looking. But definitely want to retain the staff that we have, and we strongly encourage them to advance their education and hope that they stay with us for that.
Thank you.
Representative Coward and then Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A comment and a question. First of all, public health has been a long-term interest of mine. I noticed a quote that is attributed to one of our speakers in this report. We're just one major outbreak away from collapse in our public health system, and I've often commented that I think public health is that sort of invisible thing out there that we don't know what it is until it doesn't work somewhere, and then we figure it out real quickly. In my tourism economy, an outbreak of anything in one of our restaurants is a huge crisis. Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of focus we need to maintain, and I really appreciate the work that you do. My specific question to Dr. Cohn is to just simply raise, when you spoke of suicide prevention, it's an area that many of us are concerned with, and there are a number of people on this committee who are also serving on our Veterans Affairs and Emergency Services, and that is a area of concern within the veterans population and the connectivity to mental health issues. So my question is whether or not you have any breakdown in your statistics about suicides and the percentage of individuals who have served in the military. And I ask the question to just raise the awareness so that our two committees can coordinate on some of these conversations.
And would you be willing to get that information to us in writing? That would be terrific to the whole committee. Get it to the staff and then we'll give it to the committee.
Thank you,
that would be
Chair.
Great.
I'm not really seeking an immediate answer,
right,
but I think that's an important
I do
piece
too.
To
and we will be spending a lot more time, I think,
I
on
think
this
Dr.
issue.
I think Dr. Cohn would like to comment, however.
Oh, we do have those data. We'd be happy to share them with you.
Thank you.
Terrific. Representative Huffman and then Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. First, Doctor, thanks for coming. I look forward to having you back and discussing your topics further. But Ms. Leonard, and I have a health official constituent in the audience, and I know this is probably of grave concern to her. Recruiting and retention. Are you successful in Umatilla County in getting local people to fill your positions, first of all? Or do you have to recruit a lot of times from outside the area?
Chair Tomei, Representative, we are somewhat successful. We have a tendency to leave positions vacant for long gaps of time, 6 to 12 months, before we can actively find somebody. We've been very lucky with public health professionals that by sheer luck they've moved into our area.
And the people that you have going to nursing school now, are they going to Columbia Gorge, or what school are they going to?
Blue Mountain Community College.
Blue Mountain, okay. And a quick follow-up on that. When you lose, say, a nursing staff, are you losing them typically locally, or are they moving out of the area? Because I know in one situation we lost nurse practitioner, and I can't remember which small community it was, but they, I think it was out of John Day, and they moved to Baker City. for more pay. No, it was Madras. Moved out of Madras to Baker City for more pay. So are you losing them to local facilities or beyond?
By and large, we lose them to our local hospitals.
Okay.
Very quickly, Representative Maurer.
The door was open regarding the Ashland vaccination issue, and there was an AP article published last week, and I'm going to pass that out. I have a few copies. It's very interesting because it's a huge issue, and it's not just a religious issue. I think it truly is a political issue, and you know, there's both sides of the spectrum that have concerns. Last concern I have is in the House Bill 2009, where the public health funding expansion is coming from, and it currently is coming from the cigarette tax.
Is this a political comment? No, it is not political.
Okay. I believe that that is not a sustainable source, and if you can get it from the other side of the funding equation, you're going to have much greater long-term success.
I think that is a discussion that's going to be happening in another
Dr.
committee.
Dr. Cohn can advocate for that.
Okay, colleagues, I think we're just about on time. Thank you so much. Thank you, all of you, for making your presentations, bringing this information, and we will be having you back. We've just begun to touch on these issues. These are very important issues for us. And, colleagues, we won't meet on Monday morning because that's Martin Luther King's birthday. We will be meeting on Wednesday morning. That is the NAMI Day. And so we're going to be talking about mental health issues and about PSRB issues. Representative Olson and I have been on the committee that's been looking at the PSRB situation. Great. So anything quickly for the order of... All right. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Rick. Oh, and I gavel out of the hearing on human services...